For example, you are a runner, are you not?
One of the best.
A big time track star, huh? All right. Let us say, for instance, you are running a race and you suspect the opposing team has a member who is faster, stronger, more big time than yourself. What do you do then? Do you leave the track?
Hell no.
What do you do?
Run faster.
Live from the belly of the beast with your host Asad Malik comes a radio show like no other, spreading black consciousness and fighting the forces of white supremacy. This is the most revolutionary show on the airwaves. This is United Black America Radio.
All right, family, welcome back. And today we're rolling out the red, black, and green carpet for a dynamic young member of our family, Brandon Jones, founder of the Jegna Institute. This brother has been a mental health professional in our community for quite a few years going on now. Also the host of his own podcast. I came across this brother when I was doing research on the mental health issues that we face in our community. And family, this is something that we've talked about in the past. Zaza Ali mentioned it. A number of our other guests mentioned it in our work study course. We teach an entire segment on this underneath the metaphysical headline. So it's definitely relevant and it's important for members of our family. And we're going to get into a lot of different topics that are relevant to what we're doing here today. Topics like the forces that impact the black psyche, connection between what you believe and the actions and results that we produce in the black community. And of course, post-traumatic slavery disorder. So family, it is with great pleasure that I roll out the red, black, and green carpet for my man, Brandon Jones. Brandon, how you feeling, family?
I'm doing well, and it's an honor to be on your platform. Longtime subscriber and listener to your podcast, so it's good to be here. It's good to be here.
Oh, man, you're on the other side of the mic now.
The pressure is on.
You get to see how the you get to see what's behind the curtains. So, right. Yeah, glad to have you on, family, and I know you're launching your podcast as well. I want to drop some links to that. But before I get ahead of myself, and you know how I do, and the audience knows how I do, introduce yourself and your background to the audience.
Absolutely. So once again, my name's Brandon Jones. Born and raised in St. Paul, Minnesota. Yes, we do have black folks out here. I know that became more apparent when people found out about, you know, the Philando Castile shooting and things
right,
like that.
Right.
But yeah, we do have black folks out here. We ain't a huge population, about 7% of the population.
Freezing.
Yeah, and it's cold. It is cold. But I'm from here, so I'm used to it, man. It ain't nothing to me. But
right.
Yeah, I'm actually a fourth generation. My children are actually fifth generation black Minnesotans, which is really rare as well. Because most black folks that come here for either work or some other type of financial advancement or some assistance. So it's really rare to have somebody like myself. And, you know, as we continue to grow as a population in Twin Cities, I meet a lot of folks from Chicago, Milwaukee, mostly Midwestern states that move here. They just come up to Mississippi or, you know, down 94 to get here. But yeah, grew up in a household full of trauma and drama. Even though there ain't a lot of black folks here, a lot of the issues that black people have across the nation do rear its ugly head here in the Twin Cities. So I grew up with a lot of trauma and drama, a lot of domestic violence in the home. You know, my life took a kind of an interesting turn a couple weeks before my 12th birthday. I found out that my stepfather was not my real dad. And that was like a huge shakeup for me. And as I'm entering my, you know, quest of a manhood as turning 12, getting peach fuzz on my face, under my, you know, getting hair under my armpits to find out that this man that I kind of did not like was not my father. So I went through a lot of emotional just struggles as a young dude. I'm trying to figure that out. Actually did meet my biological father shortly after finding that out. He wasn't the greatest guy either. So at that time, I had told myself I can never depend on men, black men more specifically. And I kept that kind of negative mindset or what we would call a limited mindset or limited point of view till I was in my early 20s. So I'm navigating the world without even cultivating healthy relationships with Black men, and which is a hindrance. I think a lot of us experience that, both males and females. So on that quest, though, still trying to be a Black man, looking for various different people to be role models to myself, people that I can depend on, and just taking little elements of them and pushing forward. Like, I kind of crack people up because I always say one of my biggest influences is 50 Cent. Like, 50 Cent taught me a lot about manhood, masculinity, and being assertive. And people laugh, and I'm like, man, like, you don't understand how important he was to my development as a man. Just watching his moves, man, and where he came from, I related a lot with 50 Cent. So it's kind of funny. But yeah, I'm a young dude. I'm a millennial. Went to college, first generation college student. Happy to be on campus, not knowing what the heck I was doing there. I actually went to school originally to be a dentist because I knew dentists made a lot of money, but I had no mentorship. I didn't know nothing about dentistry. Got put on academic probation my first semester because I could not keep up. You know, I'm a product of public school, WIC, Section 8, and welfare, man. Like, that's my life. And it was a challenge to make that adjustment in that environment. Didn't really know what I was doing, just really happy to be there. I was fronting. I was telling people I was on the football team, and I wasn't, but it made sense because I knew a bunch of football players, and I was a Black dude on campus. So I was able to survive that way. But I had two people that kind of shifted my mindset a little bit. And, you know, they didn't do too much cultivating or mentorship, but they just dropped these little jewels on me that altered my state. And they both were women. One was a professor I had who pointed me out in middle class, and she kind of put me on Front Street and told me, you know, I was taking a sociology class at the time when I was on academic probation. That was the only class I was actually passing. I had like a high B in this class. And one day I was just in the zone in class answering questions, and she stopped me in the class and said, whoever's studying with this kid, you know, for the next exam is going to pass. And I just like, whoa, like, she just put me out there. So I stepped to her after class, told her I didn't appreciate that. And she said, no, you're really good at this. And I didn't really know what it was. The class was called People and Problems. And I just figured that's why I was doing well, because I knew a bunch of people with a bunch of problems. And she said, no, this is what we call sociology. You should think about getting a PhD in this. Now, mind you, I'm a first generation college student. Nobody in my family has went to college. You know, I made it there. I made it. I was the champion for the family to make it. So I didn't know how to get a PhD. You know, this is 2004. I heard of it because, you know, Diddy had mentioned it in a song, right? You know, you got a PhD, a play degree. So I knew that there was something called a PhD. Didn't know really what it was. Never even thought about myself having one. But she opened that door, and I literally left that conversation with her, went talk to my guidance counselor, and switched my major from pre-dentistry to sociology. Now, financially, probably not the best move, but I was on a quest to help my people from a different way, because I knew, you know, that sometimes I can think a little differently than most of my peers. And I had some gifts and understanding kind of social dynamics and behaviors. So sociology opened that up for me. And then the second person was I had an extra guidance counselor because I was on a special program where they let little Black kids come to big universities. So I had two guidance counselors, and my specialized multicultural guidance counselor, she's a Black woman. She's from North Minneapolis, which is where most Black people in the Twin Cities end up, is over north in North Minneapolis. And she had set me down. She had probably one of the realest conversations any professional has ever had with me. And she said, Brandon, you're a Black male. Look at the people you came into this college with. Most of these people are not going to be with you in the next 4 years, but you got to make sure that you're there. We can get you in, but it's really hard to keep you here and to have you guys graduate. And that just blew my mind. And the crazy thing was, I graduated on time, and she was right. Like, from my high school, they brought us in a program. It was 13 of us. We weren't all Black males. There's probably about 6 Black males, and then the other 7 were females or other ethnic groups of males. But she was right. Only 6 of us graduated on time. 3 more of us graduated later, and the other 4 folks never even graduated, man. So, you know, the statistics rang true. And I made it. And from there, I just continued my education, went to grad school, got a master's in what's called in psychology, social psychology. And then from there, I realized that I wanted to be in mental health. So I went and got another degree in psychotherapy. And I've been doing therapy now for about 4 years. You know, I got a lot of accolades. I'm well known in the Twin Cities for talking about trauma, both intergenerational trauma and historical trauma as it pertains to Black folks. You know, many people in the audience might not have heard of, but it's a big thing in social services called the ACE study, which is Adverse Childhood Experiences. So I'm one of the facilitators in the state that talks about that as well. So that's a little bit of my history, how I got to this point to be a therapist. I'm also a dad and a husband. I'm married, got two daughters, which also is a part of my trauma, is understanding how to be a father, a Black man, understand how to be a father in Minnesota. I had no framework to be a dad, right? So it's a learning experience. And also, I didn't grow up with girls. I have two younger brothers, so I grew up with boys. So it's been an adjustment for me being a husband, a father, and being a Black man trying to raise Black kids in an enormously white state, both weather-wise and people-wise. So it's an adjustment, man, but I'm out here. I'm here for my people, and I'm pushing forward.
You know, I've always said a couple of things. I've said, number one, just because you go to college doesn't mean you're educated. It doesn't
Not
give
at all.
You the ability to bring out a knowledge of who you are. And just because you go to college doesn't mean you should be applauded. It's what you do with that education afterwards that matters in the context of our community. See, we have a lot of brothers and sisters who take what they learn and take their new abilities and they run straight into the white world. All right. So this is a brother who has matriculated through school and then kept those skill sets right in the community for the benefit of the community, helping us resolve some very serious issues. Now, you mentioned two types of trauma. Before we get really into our conversation, there are brothers and sisters who might have never heard these terms. Do you want to break down those two types of trauma that you began to touch on?
Absolutely. So the broader version of this trauma I'm talking about is called intergenerational trauma. And what this is the notion that when groups go through traumatic experiences, a lot of times we are, and this is just human nature, we will develop cultural norms to adjust to the situations that we go through. And we pass those kind of cultural norms on from one generation to the next. Now, unfortunately, Black folks have gone through what's called historical trauma. And usually when we talk about historical trauma, we talk about the legacy of slavery. And we've had to adjust as a group to survive. And unfortunately, a lot of the ways that we have adjusted have been unhealthy for us and have reproduced this traumatic experience. And then you add that on with, you know, the system of racism, white supremacy on top of that, that helps facilitate the dysfunction and the traumatic experience. That is, in a nutshell, how you combine the two. So you have intergenerational trauma, which is this passing of traumatic experiences from one generation to the next. And then historical trauma, which identifies a mark in time where the trauma either began or was developed. So for us, it would have started with the transatlantic slave trade and a lot of the wars that happened on the continent of Africa. That's really where it started, but it was really systemized and institutionalized once we touched shore here in the Western Hemisphere.
Right. So I see this two ways. I see this as being a collective experience that led to trauma, which is, of course, what we call the Ma'afa. That's the period of great suffering that began with the wars on the African continent that started in 1512 and basically continued until today. And then there are what we call generational curses, right? Some families have this term that they use, generational curse. Like it's a generational curse that we've passed down throughout the ranks and throughout the ages. Is that a good summation?
Absolutely, yes. That's definitely the way that as Black folks, we have talked about our intergenerational trauma, right? I mean, there's actually specific places that have like these really horrific things. Like I know in the DMV Baltimore area, they have a high level like child molestation and sexual assault in that area.
Right.
That doesn't get talked about in the Black community. Dr. Patricia Newton talks about this, right? So that's that is a intergenerational trauma that is specific towards one geographic area where we have a high density of Black folks. I mean, there's others too. I mean, we have this all throughout. You know, you can look at sexual abuse is one that's easy to talk about because we don't talk about it enough, but we know it happens in the community. We can talk about domestic violence. We can talk about, fragmented families, mass incarceration. When you have generations of males, now even women, who go to prison, like grandpa was in jail, daddy in jail, I'm in jail. Matter of fact, I had a client. this is crazy. I had a client. He was locked up with his dad and his grandfather. And I'm just like, man, that is intergenerational trauma,
Yeah, you are definitely not unheard of. Definitely right. not unheard of. And the thing about that is you become so clouded with the effects of that trauma that you don't see that as a problem. You feel powerless to affect that those patterns of behavior. And so you just feel like it's your destiny.
Right. It's normal. Everybody that I know goes through this. And that's the framework, right? So you're not doing anything out of the norm. So it must be okay.
And then going back to your story, becoming a PhD candidate was outside of the framework of your reality, right?
Right.
Until you had someone intervene and you know, kind of start pointing you in a better direction. They were able to point out some of your strengths. They gave you an outlet for those strengths that were productive. Talk a little bit about those who are going through generational curses can have some type of outside force introduced to them that'll either disrupt their negative patterns of behavior or how they can educe that within themselves. Because to me, that seems like something that's, you're asking a lot of a person who may not have the skills, may not even realize that they're in destructive patterns of behavior to change those patterns of behavior of their own accord. So what is it going to take?
Great question. Great question. Three things come to mind. The first thing, and two of these are going to be kind of simple solutions that most people are going to be like, what? How's it going to help me deal with my trauma? But it will. The first one is what they're already doing. If they're subscribed or they're listening to this broadcast, they're already starting to inform themselves with information that goes against the common narrative that we have as Black people. The things that you talk about, the things that I share in the circles that I'm in, these are not common narrative and talking points that happen for Black folks. So informing ourselves is very important. The second thing is exposure to different environments. A lot of times people think that this means we got to go out the country, which I think is a great experience and does help. But sometimes it's just taking yourself out of that normal day-to-day routine that you have just to experience something new. Because what that does is that opens up your worldview. That opens up your perspective of society, your perspective of other people, and that helps you adjust. And if you have kind of what I call a hustler's mindset, you know, you seek opportunities where opportunities may be, and you're able to see where other people can't necessarily see things, right? Exposure is a huge thing. And I think a lot of times as Black folks, we're so comfortable in our spaces that it's hard for us to expand out into other things. And then the third thing, which, and this is my bias, get help. You know, it doesn't have to be professional mental health help, but you have to start doing something different, right? Whether you're dealing with a life coach, whether you just, you know, you cultivate a group of a support network with your friends or some loved ones, and y'all start dealing with some and being honest and dealing with some of the pain and situations that have happened. Now, that's very hard. A lot of people don't get to that point, right? It doesn't, and I say this as someone who's in this mental health field, it doesn't have to be a professional person. The key is for you, right? The key is for you to be honest about it, to ask questions, and be willing to deal with some of this difficult things that you go through. You know, one more thing on this. A lot of times when I'm in the community and I'm doing this work around trauma, there's this term called healing that comes up. So a lot of people reference it as healing. And what they'll talk about how people need to heal from the pain that they've experienced. They speak on it as it is a destination. And healing is not a destination. It's a journey. It's a process that you will always go through. You know, myself included, I've seen a lot of horrific things. I've seen my mother in some very, you know, traumatic states, you know, due to domestic violence. Those memories and those things are never going to go away. But I have learned, I've dealt with them both on a professional, and I went to therapy myself, but also on a daily basis. I work on myself to make sure if I ever get triggered or if those visions come up or whatever, I have coping skills. I have skills to address those things and keep moving. And also I have awareness of what it is. Now, early in my 20s, I didn't have awareness, but yeah, go ahead.
No doubt. So I want to talk about awareness and I want to talk about coping skills. So first of all, how does one develop an awareness that they need to do some work on themselves? I realize that in doing the work that I've been doing, and I'm sure you might realize this as well, that there are a lot of people walking around in that fog. They don't identify with the negative outcomes that they produce. They don't realize that they're suffering from trauma. And because of that, the results and actions that they produce may not be coherent with what it is that they see and think that they're capable of, right? Mm-hmm. So there could be some people who are engaging in domestic violence and they don't realize that it's a problem. That's reality, family. There are people who are out there abusing people and doing just some really horrific sociopathic things and they might not even be aware of the impact of their behavior. So how does that process even start? How do I self-identify, okay, I got a problem?
Great question. So so I kind of approach this two different ways. The first one comes from, and I know, I believe you're familiar with Mr. Nellie Fuller Jr., right? And Mr. Fuller
Absolutely. If for those guests who might not know who Dr. Nellie Fuller is, he's one of the preeminent sociologists in our community. He wrote a number of books, including The Compensatory Code, and he gives us a blueprint for what white supremacy is and what white supremacy looks like. So go ahead, pick it back up. I hope I didn't break your flow with that.
Oh, no, you're all good. Mr. Fuller is very important. The book that he wrote is very important for us to understand how to deal with ourselves. It's not written like a self-help book, but believe it or not, it is. And one of the big things that's very consistent in the things that Mr. Fuller talks about and in his book is, are the results of what you do constructive or non-constructive? Not good or bad, not beneficial, but is it constructive? Is it working? Right? A lot of times we might get in unhealthy relationships. We might be working jobs. We might be dealing with family members. We might be doing things that is not beneficial to our well-being. And sometimes you have to make a determination. Is this a constructive result for me? Like, what is this doing for me? And if it's not, that's the awareness piece. You have to be honest with yourself and let yourself know, if this is not working, I need to make a change. And sometimes that change comes with a great sacrifice, like cutting off family members. Like, how do you stop talking to mom, right? And mom is very unhelpful for you. Like, mom's draining your bank account. She's stressing you out. She's pushing you to your limits. And it's hard for you to get what you need to get done for yourself. Now, that might sound selfish because as Black folks, we're conditioned to always take care of everybody, no matter what circumstance we're in. But sometimes you have to do some self-work so you can be in a better position to help the other people around you. So that's my first answer to that. My second would be checking your stress levels. One thing that we don't do very well as Black folks is monitor our stress. You know, and we could do that a couple different ways, but we know when we're stressed out because you can just look at us. Sometimes we'll just tell you.
Right, definitely. And a lot of these brothers and sisters out there that are suffering from high blood pressure and mm-hmm. other medical issues, that's a direct result of mm-hmm. nothing more than stress. Now, all of us can eat a little better, me included, and I'm making a vegan transition. But a lot of you will, by managing your stress, and I think we're going to get into coping skills, so I'm not going to steal your thunder, but by managing your stress, you can begin to mitigate the effects of a lot of these other illnesses that you're suffering from. But what are some stress markers? So, okay, we can look at ourselves. We can tell that we're stressed. But still, there are brothers and sisters out there that lack that knowledge of self, that self-awareness to be able to point out to themselves, all right, I'm getting stressed out over this.
Right. Typically, what I say to analyze your stress, look at what I call extremes. Are you sleeping way too much? Are you sleeping way too less? Are you eating way too much? Are you eating way too less? Like, are you on these two different spectrums of these categories? So sleeping, eating, your relationships. Do your relationships seem phony because it's all good? And it's all good. Or are they super chaotic, right? Because they're just dysfunctional. If you're on extremes of a lot of these different markers, typically you're stressed out. Do you feel like you're working not enough so you don't got no money? Or do you feel like you're being overworked at your job or what you do? Or do you feel extremely stressed out because you're trying to be an entrepreneur? Or are you extremely stressed out because your products aren't necessarily put together correctly? Or you got too much merchandise and you don't know how to move it? Like, where are you at on these kind of extreme levels of the continuum? That's how you measure stress. When you look at kind of stress-related diseases, Black folks are usually top three in those areas, no matter what they are. And a lot of that has to do with living in the system of racism, white supremacy. Absolutely. And a lot of it has to do with we have not adjusted correctly to the system. And since that, we built a culture around surviving and not a culture around evolving. And since we're just trying to survive, we just do what we need to do to make it to the next checkpoint. Mm. And that type of living is stressful as well.
True indeed. True indeed. We could spend the whole episode talking about this one point. And to be honest with you, I don't think we've even gotten into the questions because this is such a nuanced and important issue. We might have to have you back on. But okay, for those brothers and sisters that are able to identify, okay, I need some help and I need to start by coping with my stressors, right? I need to start by developing some coping strategies. What advice could you give those, especially those who are currently in those negative environments, they don't have a way to get out, They don't have any transportation. They don't have the means of liberating themselves from whatever that negative environment is right now. It could be an abusive relationship. It could be one person packed into a home of five negative spirits, right? So what are some coping strategies? It could be brothers and sisters who are surrounded by white supremacists at work and they know it. So how do we cope with our stress?
Yeah, context matters, right? So I'm gonna try to give some general answers, but context definitely matters because depending on your situation, kind of depends on how you would move, right? But I'm gonna try to give some general things. A coping skill that often gets, white folks do this all the time. They love this stuff, especially liberal white folks, but we can get into all that. But they love mindfulness. Now they do it in ways that are very Eurocentric. They just take what they want from other people's culture and make it their own. But meditation's good, right? We talk a lot about meditation, and most people I know, they're like, man, I can't meditate. But you really should take that time, even if it's 3 minutes. I try to start people off very small, 3 minutes of silence. Now, it's hard for a lot of folks to get away to do this. So sometimes I just say, get some soft music, go on YouTube, type in massage music. That's what that's what I tell people type in. And you'll get like the music they play at massage parlors if you ever go get a massage. Very soft music. Turn that on, put some headphones on, close your eyes and sit up straight.
So soft music.
Yep, soft music. If you can't sit in silence, because some people just can't do it, put on some soft music, sit up straight, like what we call sit with dignity, close your eyes, and just take 3 minutes to just let your mind rest. That's a coping skill, right? Another thing that I talk about is developing your social and emotional intelligence skills. And this is something that's, you know, it takes work. And these are solutions that are more simple than people think. But this is coping. This is coping. Mm-hmm. So social emotional intelligence is divided into kind of four categories. So you have self-awareness, social awareness, self-management, and then what's called social skills or relationship management. And then for self-awareness, what I typically tell people is the first thing you got to do when you are trying to be self-aware is you need to slow down. We live in a society that is very task-oriented. Got to go from one checkpoint to the next. You got to just keep moving. It reminds me of the game Sonic the Hedgehog, where you just hit a checkpoint, you run to the next checkpoint. That's how kind of our lives are set up. So slowing down, processing things, and then understanding your thoughts and your feelings about particular things. You know, why do you feel the type of way you feel? What's got you feeling some type of way about what's going on? And then processing those emotions. You know, why are you frustrated with your partner every time they give you that certain look or they say something to you? Why do you hate going into your job every day? What exactly is it about it that has you feeling the way that you feel? When you start to do some of those deeper dives, that's what self-awareness does. But it only works if you slow down. So you have to kind of slow yourself down. And I think meditation is kind of helpful for that because it allows our minds to literally rest and for us to process some of these thoughts and feelings that we have. And like I said, start off small, 3 minutes. Typically, you know, it'd be good for you to have 10 minutes of meditation a day. Just 10. That's all it takes. Just like 15 minutes of exercise physically for your body every day does wonders. 10 minutes of mindfulness does wonders for people if they do it daily. So that's one level is self-awareness of social emotional intelligence. The second level is social awareness, right? And this is about being able to stay control in a kind of a social manner. Now, sometimes things ain't in our control. Right. The police pull you over. You don't know what's going to happen. You got to just do the best that you can do to make it home safely in that interaction. Right. But trying to stay in control of yourself is very important. And that's how you impact the social piece around you. Right. And what I say is when you want to stay in control, first, you got to understand what are your values. Right. What do you value? That's going to help keep you in check. Do you value your children? Do you value the income you make? Do you value your people? That's going to help you stay in control and to monitor and manage what you're trying to do. So knowing your values and why those are your values is very important. The next thing, and this is one that's very huge for our social awareness, is holding ourselves accountable. As Black folks, we are very good at trying to hold everybody else accountable for what's wrong with us collectively, but we got to do our part first.
You know what? No. That's such a powerful point. I do want to interject just real quickly. When I'm teaching leaders in our organization, one of the principles that I teach them is accountability. Everything that happens in your sphere, in your cipher, in the world around you is your doing. You caused it to happen. Now, some people may say, well, how is a police officer pulling me over and then wrongly incarcerating me, something that is of my doing? How is this abusive relationship of my doing? I have people under me that aren't performing. I have people around me who aren't fulfilling their promises. How is that my doing? And we can get into that. The power in making that statement is that puts you in control of everything in the world around you. And if your intentions are good, you can start changing those circumstances for the better. Now, you're the professional here, and this is why I brought you on. Mm-hmm. So I just want to I want to stay with accountability first. So the questions that I propose, those hypothetical questions, what would be the answer to that? If I'm holding myself accountable for everything that happens in my environment, how do I hold myself accountable for being put in an abusive relationship? How do I hold myself accountable for finding myself in a system of white supremacy when these things are coming at me from third parties?
Yeah. Now, those are two different answers to both of those questions for me.
I already know.
So, yeah. So how do you hold yourself accountable for being in an abusive relationship? Now, all right. One thing that we have to do is be honest with ourselves. If we're in an abusive relationship, and this is for males and females, because don't get it twisted, men can be in abusive relationships as well. You gotta be honest with yourself and ask yourself, do I deserve this? Right? Not why is this person doing this to me? Not that. You know, not what's going to happen next if I stay. Do I deserve this? You got to have some level of self-esteem and some self-honor and integrity to say, do I deserve this? And if you don't, then your next question should be, how do I get out of this situation? Right. And that's that, you know, there's a lot of other factors. It's not always clean like that. But these are the things you should do a self-check on and hold yourself accountable, is asking you, do you deserve this? Do you have enough self-esteem and dignity to deal with that type of, you know, abuse? Now, when it comes to living in a system of racism, white supremacy, and, you know, how do you hold yourself accountable on that? Once again, I would say back to being honest, right? One of the biggest challenges we have as Black people is being honest, even to say that we live in a system of racism, white supremacy. Now, it's become more common to even hear that term, white supremacy, as a talking point, because when I dived into the conscious community 6 years ago, white supremacy was just almost something exclusive to us. And now you hear it on mainstream TV, which blows my mind.
You know what? When I first started doing this podcast, one of the things that everyone admonished me to tiptoe around was using that phrase white supremacy. And this is back when websites like Stormfront were up. And so mm-hmm. white supremacy was very real. You had reference points. It just wasn't spoken in public, right?
Right.
We were one of the very first platforms. I'm sure there were some other platforms out there, but we were the platform that introduced that phrase. And then, of course, you had other people like some documentary producers out there who took it to the next level. But I'm taking credit where I shouldn't be, because it was really Dr. Neely Fuller who's been talking about white supremacy for decades. He inspired people like Dr. Francis Kress Welsing. Right. But all this falls within the field of Black psychology sociology.
Right.
Right. And then, of course, you have Umar Johnson, who's a psychologist as well. Mm-hmm. So
Dr. Joy DeGruy-Leary. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely.
But we got to be honest about that. Right. So now that it's become a term in kind of the national narrative, we have to know what they do. Right. Know what white folks do. Once they start introducing things, they will reduce the threat in that term. That's why it was so underground, because it highlighted what they are. So watch how they spin the narrative on what white supremacy is. So now everybody's using the term, so it loses its meaning. So be very careful with that, but being honest about it. What is it, right? It is people calling you the N-word in your face. It's burning crosses. That's the overt version. But the covert white supremacy is what we're dealing with now. We're in a very refined system of racism, white supremacy now. And that's the piece that we're very ignorant on. So how do you hold yourself accountable? It's understanding how refined white supremacy works, right? And it's in policy. It's in decisions that are made on school boards. It's in zoning. It's in these things that we need to educate ourselves in. Some of this stuff is political. Right. Some of this stuff is financial. Some of this stuff is just daily planning things that we actually could change if we were involved and at the table. Like I honestly believe that, because I'm in some of these circles where I can influence decisions and I'm just one. So I'm like, man, if I can get six of us up in this room, we might be able to make some things happen. And I'm in Minnesota. There ain't a lot of us, right?
That's all it takes. And when you're talking about how white supremacy works, of course, the audience who is initiated, they know that we talk about the weapons of white supremacy, mm-hmm. miseducation, miscegenation, murder, fraud, prosecution, integration, infection, intoxication, things like that. Gentrification is a new one when you're talking about zoning laws, when you're talking about there's a phrase that's going on around environmental justice, and it's been going on for years. Mm-hmm. Well, that's intoxication. Intoxication is consumption of any harmful substance. That's food, water, air. Yeah, those are the weapons of white supremacy. And the reason why it's important for us to put a target on them is because, first of all, we want to separate the people from the behavior. We're not racist, and we don't think that all white people are out to get us. All right. But it's a possibility. But when we target certain behaviors and we target certain actions and we target the mechanisms of the system of white supremacy, then we can bring that system to its heels, at least as it relates to us, right? Because we can't keep building if somebody comes along and destroys what we've worked so hard to build for decades and centuries. And of course, we all know about Tulsa, which is Black Wall Street and what happened there. So we've got to work diligently at stopping the system of white supremacy. And that is something that we can take responsibility for. See, it's outside of your control when someone is doing something to you, but it becomes within your control when you can do something to affect change, when you can do something to protect yourself, when you can do something to mitigate the damages caused by that system of white supremacy.
Right. And also disarming it, right? There are things that we can do to help curb some of the systematic things that have been set up for us to fail and for other people to benefit off our failure. Like, we don't have to fill up prisons. We don't. If we adjust it collectively and stop some things, then they would have to make their adjustments to keep their system going. But if we continue to be dysfunctional in our behaviors, they'll just do what they do. And I'm not saying that all white people do this, but they all benefit from a system that was created by their managers.
Absolutely. If we're being real, family, I mean, let's not help the system of white supremacy along. Yes, prosecution is used as a weapon. Yes, we have the new Jim Crow. Don't make it easier for them.
Yeah.
Right. Don't engage in behaviors that you know are going to have a negative outcome. No raping, no robbing, no pillaging. Right. Let's not help the system along. But go ahead, family.
No, I mean, you're right on point, man. Like, you know, there's some that we have the ability to make choices that can better ourselves collectively. That's not being racist. That is self-interest, right? And we have choices individually and we have choices as a collective. And we have to make sure that when we're making these choices that they're constructive. And if they're not, then we don't do it. And that's just something that we have lost. One of the ways that we've coped and we've adjusted, and this is a psychological thing too, when we talk about group, kind of groupthink, is we've learned to always follow the instrumentation or the direction of other groups, mainly white folks. If a white man comes on here on this platform, they wouldn't come on this platform to say this, but if they went on another platform and said the things that I'm saying today, a lot of black folks are going to take it as the gospel. Right. But if Dr. Umar Johnson comes on and says it somewhere, it comes with scrutiny. And that's a problem. That's a huge problem. Now, there's other we're not going to talk about him. But there's issues with that.
True indeed. And it should come under scrutiny. Like, let's not get it twisted. A lot of the theories that are being put out there should be scrutinized because that's part of healthy academic discourse. Right. We got to know and we have to verify and we have to believe that the scholars that bring information to the family are right and exact, because we've been fed a lot of BS from a lot of different kinds of people. So that part is healthy.
Yes. Right?
But when we're doing it in a way that is destructive, you're tearing down this brother just to tear down this brother, right? So if you're feeling some type of way because you have a member of the community, and I've encountered these kinds of people, by the way, these kinds of people are out there. They might not say it overtly, right? They might not come out and say, I don't like this brother because he sounds better than I do. I don't like this brother because he's built a better platform than I've built. That is a reality, right? So I'll just, for lack of a better term, I'll call them haters. They're out there. Mm-hmm. And so it's that we kind of got to watch out for. Like, yes, academically scrutinize everyone. I tell all the members of our organization, everyone that goes through any of the courses or anything that I'm involved with, do the knowledge for yourself, right? So verify and ask for verification, ask for references, ask people to cite their sources. Right. And if you know how to look at those sources and they make sense to you, then it's gospel. And if not, then we need to continue our academic discourse. Go ahead, fam.
I like that you came back with that, because I actually agree with you But see, one thing that we have to do is we have to build our ability to assess better as people. And we can be critical of people and not necessarily have to tear them down. And it doesn't always happen, but that's how we should actually start moving, right? We should be more proactive versus reactive to situations. So if we're thinking and we're using logic, chances are we're going to be proactive. We'll take, you know, information from anybody, apply it to us as a group or individually, and keep it moving. But typically what we do is we see who's saying what, and then we base our decision making based on how we feel about the actual person who's saying it, which is not good. So in a nutshell, you know, social emotional intelligence is one of the coping skills, and I highly recommend people do that. There's tons of material online. Just Google it, go to YouTube. You can find a lot of free resources to help manage just your stress level and some of your mental health. You know, a lot of the times we think about mental health. Yes, we can talk about more of the serious things like OCD, schizophrenia, major depression. For Black folks, we deal with a lot of anxiety issues. And a lot of these issues can be self, quote unquote, medicated, even though we do self-medication. But a lot of times when we do, we are using unhealthy methods. We don't apply a lot of these other things that require us to do some more mental work. We just soothe our pain with, you know, sex, violence, drugs, alcohol, food, all these things. But there are things out there to help us, like social emotional intelligence. Doesn't cost you anything to learn this stuff and to apply it in your life and see if it works and improves your emotional health and your mental health.
Give us some books that'll help us learn that intelligence that you're talking about.
Oh, sure. That's why I need to get my book done. One book that's really good is by Daniel Goleman. Now, he's a white man, because I know some folks don't like to read books by folks that ain't Black, but there's a lot of important information in this book around social emotional intelligence. And that's the title of the book. It's just called Social Emotional Intelligence. He has several different versions of it, but if you just search Daniel Goleman, G-O-L-E-M-A-N, you'll find him. You can even go on YouTube. He's got some material in there too, because, you know, for folks who don't like to read, you can get that. You can access the information online that way as well. But that, I think that that's a good start when you talk about social emotional intelligence and understanding how to move forward. For more of the heavy readers, anything by Dr. Amos Wilson. Dr. Amos Wilson's talking about us, but it's therapeutic in nature because he's giving you the layout of what's happening. And he wrote these books back in the 80s and early 90s, man. He's giving you the layout of what's happening, what we can do about it. And that is therapeutic in nature. So Dr. Amos Wilson, anything by Dr. Amos Wilson is good. Daniel Goleman has some good books. Who else would I recommend when it comes to social emotional intelligence? Those would probably be a good start. But just in general, I think if you just type it in, you can find tons of different people who talk about it that fit your needs and your level of comfort and understanding.
Good resources. I can't co-sign Dr. Amos Wilson enough. Again, another Black psychologist.
Yeah. The other book that I would suggest is Black Pain by Terry Williams. I think she's a social worker. I can't remember. I read this book a couple of years ago, but I still got it. This book is good. Now, it's kind of tailored towards women a bit. So for the men out there, don't get, you know, sidetracked, because I think that the information in there is still beneficial for us to read as well. But yeah, Terry Williams, she's a clinical social worker. She wrote a book called Black Pain. Phenomenal book. Phenomenal book.
Definitely adding it on to the list. So as we get close to the end of the interview, first of all, did you finish up your thought from that previous question?
Yeah, for the most part, you know, working on our social emotional intelligence skills is important. Finding those resources, whether they're in book form. But if you're not a reader, go to YouTube, man. We don't use YouTube good enough. YouTube should be pumping out degrees, because there's so much free information on there that we don't necessarily always use as Black folks. Use YouTube and use that platform as a weapon to not just get informed, but to also, you know, share your ideas as well.
Right. We had a guest on a few episodes back. Max Maxwell made his first $21,000 in wholesaling real estate through what he called YouTube University. Yeah. Like, so many of you all go to YouTube and you're watching either Conscious Debates, Sonnetta TV. No diss on Sonnetta. All right. Some of y'all came into consciousness through Sonnetta, but it's a little sensational at times. So I definitely agree with you there. YouTube is a powerful tool. There's no excuse. How do I ... no one should be getting any of those questions because of the amount of information that's out there. Now, how do I decipher which practice is going to get me to my goal for the fastest, which is the most right and exact for melanated people? That's a question that we should start raising, but there's no shortage of information. As we get close to the end, I've always said that we shouldn't be looking at the results that we produce as a community per se, all right? Because the results are just a product of our thoughts and emotions. And our thoughts and emotions are just a product of our beliefs. So if we truly want to impact our communities, then we need to look at the beliefs that we hold about ourselves and our community and the world around us. So my question is, can you just build on that thread? Can you build on the connection between one's beliefs, emotions, thoughts, and actions? And what does that connection mean for the Black community?
Absolutely. So, you know, this question reminds me of Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, and she talks about that our thoughts, speech, actions, emotional responses, and our perceptions help determine how we move as a people. So our own core beliefs are going to dictate our behaviors. So it's important to formulate what our core beliefs are. And that might be different for different people, but the main thing that I try to do in anything that I put out is get people to think about, is it constructive or is it non-constructive? If your core belief is that working out is the solution to Black people's problems, okay, that might be constructive for a lot of us, but what are you going to add to it? Or who can you connect with who has a different core belief that's somewhat in line with yours, but it also helps build the community moving forward? So, you know, always informing ourselves is very important when it comes to our beliefs, and our beliefs may change. Like, I used to believe that multiculturalism was the way to go. That changed. I don't think that that's the way to go. I think that we need to learn. But now I have a core belief that we need to think globally as people, right? So everything that I do, I start here in the United States, but I try to reference and get people to think about, what does it look like in 2025 with Black folks when we over in China working with the Chinese, right? See, multiculturalism is a little different than that. When I'm talking about having a global presence as an individual, how do we do that, right? How do we work interchangeably with other folks? I mean, that's a core belief that I have. So
position of strength, not a position of dependence.
Right, right. And that's what we have to do because that affects my emotions. So I can't get mad when something, you know, doesn't happen my way because I have to learn from that experience and keep it moving so it can fit back into my core belief. So our core beliefs are important. A lot of people don't know what their core beliefs are. So here's an exercise for you. Here's a little cognitive behavioral therapy exercise. Take some time. This goes back to that meditation thing. You need to take some time. It doesn't have to be long. Take 5 minutes out of your day. You can do this in the bathroom. Get a pen and piece of paper. I know people don't have it anymore. I know you're on your phone. So if you glue to your phone, get your phone, get whatever note app you can on your phone, and just try to list 10 core beliefs. Now, most people ain't got 10 core beliefs, but just try to get 10. And of those beliefs, think about, is this a constructive belief or is this non-constructive? Is this belief helping me or is this belief not helping me? And what can I do to improve this, right? That's cognitive behavioral therapy. That's you thinking, first you're going to have emotional response to the things that you've already seen. You're going to have a thought, then you're going to have an emotional response, and then it's going to lead to an action. So yeah, what are your core beliefs? We got to know what those are first. You know, chances are it's going to be something around finances, something around family. It might be even something around education or employment. Then it might be something around a legacy. Like, what are you trying to leave behind? And most people don't know what that is because we're just so used to going from, you know, one thing to the next day by day. And that's what trauma does. It makes everything about the moment. But just processing that out and having a thorough understanding of what your actual core beliefs are is very important.
Well said, family. Well said. And we teach initiates in the conscious community to divide those up between five elements of life, physical, metaphysical, resources, relationships, and academics. So you right on target and we're on the same wavelength. And this hour definitely flew by. We would love to have you back on in the future if you're going to be available to get really deep into some of these, because my whole purpose was to give brothers and sisters an overview of this field, an introduction to mental health in the Black psyche, because these are phrases that people throw around a lot.
Right.
But when we really get into the weeds of it, I don't think enough people have a working knowledge of that field. And by working knowledge, I mean, can you make this practical to you? Are we just mentally masturbating and talking about the Black mind, post-traumatic slavery disorder, generational curses, or is this something that I can apply to my life? to make me a more integral and healthy part of nation building. And mm-hmm. so I definitely want to have you on, family, but let the audience know how they can support you, what you have going on. Talk a little bit about the Jegna Institute. I don't even think we got into the topic of what a Jegna is. So if you want to build on that,
yeah, we didn't.
The floor is yours.
All right, cool. So yeah, Jegna is a term that a lot of folks haven't heard of. A lot of folks even struggle to pronounce. They say Jenga like the board game, but it's Jegna. It translates, it's an African culture term that comes from the area that's now known as Ethiopia. And what a Jegna is a person who's still growing, still learning, and still with potential and attempts to do, you know, positive things in the community for themselves and for the community in general. So it's more than a leader. It's someone who, you know, they stand on their own, but they also have the awareness to do something for their community. And that's what I try to do with all my work, is build Jegnas from a therapeutic standpoint. How do I help you move from this point of depression or anxiety that you're at now to a point where you stand on your own, you understand what you've been through, and now you're trying to build something for your future. So the work for me is very important, because a lot of the principles and things that I talk about are things that I put myself through too. Just so I knew that when I'm teaching anything, whether I learned it from the institution of therapy or not, that it actually is culturally relevant and responsive to my people. For me, that's a long answer what the Jegna Institute is. You can find me at JegnaInstitute.com. That's my site. You can check out my podcast, which is this Jegna podcast. And Jegna is spelled J-E-G-N-A, J-E-G-N-A. You punch that into YouTube. You can punch that in Google. You most likely will find me on there. Also subscribe to my YouTube channel, because I'm about to put a lot more content on YouTube as we move into 2018. You're going to expect to see a lot of videos from me as well as audio content. So those are the main places that you can find me on social media. I'm at Universal Jones on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, whatever works best for you. Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Universal Jones. No funny spelling. You should be able to find me.
No doubt. And I'll make sure to include links in the show notes to all your platforms. And in fact, we might even put together a PDF that lists a lot of the techniques that you talk about. I think this is a really important field, and the work that you're doing should be continued and made practical for brothers and sisters. This isn't just a listening podcast. Y'all know how we get down. We want to bring you the information that you can use to live a Black and conscious lifestyle and to take action in the face of white supremacy, right? Not just be entertained, not just say, oh, those brothers had an interesting and intelligent conversation. Now, we want you to be able to take action. So we might be able to put together a PDF or something like that. But we'll definitely talk about that later on. Brother Jones, definitely been a great interview. I'm glad we were able to get you on. How you feel about the interview?
This was a great interview. It was good. We didn't go as deep as we could, but if you have me back, I'm sure we'll get into it. So let's do it.
The invitation is out there, and we're going to make it happen, family. Enjoy your weekend.
Yep, you too, man. Take care.
Peace.